Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
It's time for Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz, episode 107 for February 4th, 2010, Stellarium. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show that covers free, libre, and open source software. Every week, another great free open source project. Some of the greatest thinkers in the business, and it all starts with this guy right here, Mr. Randall Schwartz, the author of Learning Perl, Just Another Perl Hacker, and Seaside Hacker, and our great man about Floss. Hello, Randall. Good to see you.
Hey, Leo. Good to see you again as well. It's kind of missed you last week, but that's okay. And you were a little busy with that Newton 2 rollout, I think.
Whatever was. That was, that thing, the iPod.
Yeah,
or whatever,
so yeah. I had to shepherd this show all on its own, but now you're back. Your dulcet tones once again contributing to this show. This is very nice. Yes. And of course, I've got for people watching the live video, they can see I've got the giant microphone again. So back home for
you sound
a bit.
Good. You sound good.
Yeah, it's a great microphone. It's very cool. I love it. It's my Blue Yeti, by the way, in case people be asking me, what is that? It's a Blue Yeti. It's a lot of
blue,
fun.
Even that might be confusing. Blue, it's not a Blue Yeti. It's Blue is the company that yes. makes it. It's a Yeti microphone, Y-E-T-I. And
Yeah,
it's a Blue Yeti, like you said.
So let's just catch up on a couple of old topics here before we get into today's show. Although, should we mention who's on the show first?
I guess. Yeah, we're going to talk about, if you're interested in astronomy, this is a great program. There are a variety of open source and free and paid also closed source programs for astronomers. Mm-hmm. Stellarium is really one of the best, just a very intuitive, easy to play with, and yet really powerful program. We're going to talk to one of the people on the Stellarium team. Matthew Gates will join us in just a little bit to talk about his program.
Indeed.
But I understand we are not deleted. That's good
That's
news.
That's right. So the Wikipedia challenge that we talked about a couple weeks ago, which is that for some reason somebody thought that Floss Weekly was not a Wikipedia-worthy topic. And it was insanely crazy to have suggested that, because if you look at the result is, after a week of voting and everything, the admin said, you guys were crazy to even suggest this. In fact, it was categorized as failed withdrawn, so as in the person who originally proposed it actually asked for it to stop.
Oh, good.
Because there were so many keep, yeah. strong keep.
Thank
I think
you,
it was
everybody.
Only two deletes. Yeah, thank you for those of you who are in the Wikipedia community and contributed to that. That really helped. So Floss Weekly still has a real Wikipedia page, which is
as it should.
Yeah, I think
can't
so.
Think
it's
of worthy. Anything more worthy of being in Wikipedia.
I mean, given that 54 of our guests also themselves have Wikipedia articles, it just didn't make any sense
Thank
to delete
you.
This crazy
Thank
show.
You. Do you not support and celebrate really? Open source software, for crying out loud?
Exactly. It was just a little crazy.
You could take us out of Britannica. Go right ahead. But not Wikipedia.
Are we in Britannica?
No.
Isn't
but if we were.
Jeans? Isn't that a jeans?
Britannica jeans, yeah. All my men wear Britannica, or they wear nothing at all.
I'm so dating myself now.
Hey, it's better than dating somebody who hates you.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. Just one other thing before we get into the guest. I was live streaming last Wednesday, I think it was, doing karaoke, and I had this great idea. Lori Lipple Walsh does your artwork for the shows and also does these great t-shirts.
Yeah, she's a great designer.
Artoftechtees.com or something like that?
Artandtechtees.com.
There you go. I knew you'd do the right thing. But I have this great idea, and I wrote her, and she says she's going to work up the artwork right away. But it's going to be a new t-shirt for all you guys that are watching the live stream now, especially. It's Leo Laporte's World, We Just Stream It. So she likes the idea. She's going to make a shirt like that. So.
She's great. She does, as you said, she does our album art. She's doing our new lower thirds for the show. Those are the graphics you see at the bottom of every screen. And she's just an amazing graphic artist who does great work. Art and Tech, TEES.com.
So that shirt's not available yet because I just suggested it to her, but I imagine within a few weeks or so she'll have the art up and you'll be able to buy that shirt. And I know I'm going to get one for sure.
And by the way, she has ladies' sizes. These are hand-screened in the U.S. By local artisan and craftsmen. And they are absolutely licensed and endorsed by TWIT LLC. All rights reserved. So this is, she's a really great person.
Wanted to give her another shout out because she'll know this happened now because she'll have like 1,000 sales, which is always
good. I hope that's the case.
Yeah, exactly. Because she does a good job for us.
Yep. Now, so, shall we, should we get Matthew on the line here?
I believe we should.
All right. Let me see if I can raise him. I believe, I may be mistaken, but I believe that's Matthew on the line right now. Hello, Matthew, Leo Laporte, Randall Schwartz. Welcome to Floss Weekly.
Hi, Leo. Hi, Randall.
Where are you? Where are you these days? Are you in the UK?
Yeah, I live in the UK.
That's why you have the wool hat on.
Yeah. It's a bitter winter.
It's a bitter winter. Even summer's a bitter winter sometimes. So tell us about Stellarium. I mean, you weren't the person who created it initially.
No. The project originator is a guy called Fabien Chereau, and he's still the lead developer. I started on the project in early 2005, actually starting just writing user documentation and slowly kind of worked my way into doing more and more development work and eventually became co-project admin. And now I sort of do administrative tasks as well as development.
So you're kind of the front man for the band.
Well, Fabian's still the main guy, really. But I'm doing this, do some publicity and stuff.
You know, there are a large number of commercial programs. Google has a program that does this. There are a lot of other programs, but this is the open source and free one. And it's on Linux, it's on Mac, it's on Windows. And it's just fantastic. I mean, I'm just so glad that Fabian and you have been working so hard to make this available to people. Who is it? Mostly schools who use this? Who uses this? It's a planetarium, right?
Yeah, well, there's quite a few different user groups. Probably the main group is just people who want to use it on their desktop computer. So that's people who are just curious about astronomy, educational use. Also, amateur astronomers use it as an observation tool to kind of plan their night's viewing and kind of be able to look up at the sky and work out what they're looking at and orientate themselves. Stellarium is also used in small planetarium systems. One of the developers, a guy called Rob Spearman, has a company called Digitalis Education who use Stellarium in their planetarium systems. So they have fisheye projectors and they run Stellarium into the fisheye projector and they project it onto the inside of an inflatable berm. And those are kind of sold to schools and to organizations which sort of give planetarium shows to schools and such like.
Was that the original goal, is to just essentially duplicate a planetarium experience?
Well, I mean, the program is really to kind of simulate the sky. The planetarium features were actually added after the initial kind of releases. Rob approached Fabian and sponsored him to write a couple of features which were useful for planetarium systems. There's a thing called the text user interface, which allows you to control Stellarium just using the keyboard. And that was then used kind of via a special keyboard driver. So you could use a remote control, which was illuminated, to control Stellarium as if that was a keyboard. So for the small planetarium systems, the operator would sit inside the planetarium just with the remote control and be able to control the product like that. That wasn't an original feature.
Now, some of us listening to this show go back to the days where the planetarium was this complex series of gears and levers and dials and the big control console that the operator had to use. And there was this giant thing that would spin around in the center of the room to, and had like the northern hemisphere on one side, the southern hemisphere on the other, and the planets around the middle and stuff. So we've essentially replaced all that with some formulas, some math. And I know that a lot of the modern planetariums have something like this that's already like they do commercially. So what you're saying is that someone could take Stellarium and hook it up to the right hardware and do the same thing using low-cost or no-cost software.
Yeah, and the sorts of planetarium projectors that you talk about are still in use. And the sort of high-end, perhaps slightly old-fashioned projectors use all sorts of techniques to project very high-resolution images onto large domes. And that includes fiber optic cables to project individual stars. So you have a big mass of fiber optic cables and special slide masks and so on, which will project nebulae and the moons and planets and things onto the dome. Something like Stellarium is kind of restricted by the resolution which you can project at. So because Stellarium uses pretty much off-the-shelf components when it's used inside a planetarium, you're typically limited to the sorts of resolutions that you'd get with a good LCD projector. And that's put through a fisheye lens. So it doesn't really compete with those sort of large systems, but for smaller planetarium systems, it's a pretty viable solution and a lot cheaper. I mean, you can imagine the kind of mechanics that goes into those old projectors. There's a lot of work in doing that, whereas if you can just hook up a piece of software to a regular off-the-shelf projector, you've got a system for very low cost.
Well, yeah, and just like a real planetarium, I mean, the sky that's moving, I mean, at a very slow rate, you can speed it up, slow it down, you can zoom in. I mean, it has all of those features. It makes an old-style planetarium look pretty primitive, actually.
One of the things, though, that I think you can do with a software planetarium like this, it's be really hard to do with a hardware planetarium, is show things like precession, though, right? I mean, those sorts of large-scale stuff, you'd have to actually spin those gears for centuries before you'd see anything that resembles precession. It wouldn't really happen.
I would imagine you can simulate it somehow by kind of having an additional kind of pivot on the projector or something. But yeah, I mean, obviously software has a lot of advantages in terms of flexibility. For a very, very low cost system, we even have a feature called spherical mirror distortion, where the output is pre-distorted to be the reflection off a spherical mirror. So you don't even have to have a fisheye lens. You can actually use a regular projector with a regular lens and put it onto a spherical mirror, which is pretty cheap. You can get a spherical mirror for, I don't know, $50 or something. I think garden centers quite often sell them as ornaments if you want to put it with a colored one. So you can use that to really make a really, really cheap kind of projection, and just for fun, you know, it's a kind of weekend project.
So the math for this thing must be pretty complex. I mean, it's obviously worked out formulas, but I mean, I've got to think, okay, so I'm standing on a spot somewhere on the Earth, and I'm looking up at the sky, but it depends on sort of what part of the year it's in. So I've got to know kind of where the sun is relative to that. And that actually sort of, because of, parallax, affects sort of even the shift of the various nearby stars. And then I have to think about, like, you know, what time of day it is, and you know whether the north is towards the sun or away from the sun. There must be a lot of math going on here. I guess I'm just astounded by it. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, I mean, there are all sorts of effects that you need to sort of take into account. I have to say that sort of stuff is not stuff that I did. The orbital mechanics and the kind of the basic sort of setup of the program was all in place before I joined the project.
Yeah, you're with me. Math is hard. Who wants to do that?
Yeah.
Right, me too. I'm just glad somebody else did it for me.
One of the early contributors to the project, called Johannes, actually has a PhD in maths, and he did a lot of the projection stuff and mechanics as well.
I think we've slowed the website down a little bit, so if people are going... People are all going to stellarium.org right now. You might want to wait a little bit to download your copy, but that's cool. That's exciting. I mean, that means there are people that are interested in this. You mentioned that amateur astronomers might use it to plan their evening. Can they also control their telescopes, things like that, with the Stellarium?
Yeah, we have telescope control up until the release. We did a release just a few days ago to coincide with the show and try to get some publicity and get some downloads from it. Until then, we've had a telescope control feature, which you've had to kind of configure by editing a .ini file, add some stuff in there. It's a little bit cumbersome to use, but we now have a plugin which has a kind of user interface for configuring telescopes. We don't support every possible telescope driver, but we support a few of the major ones. And there's a possibility of taking drivers from other open source projects. There's another a similar kind of project called KSTARS, which is part of the KD software collection. And they have much more sophisticated telescope control stuff built into KSTARS. And we actually started a kind of project to collaborate with them and to try to share code a little while ago, although nothing came of it, just because no matter and kind of go through and work things out. But you know, we maintain a friendly relationship with the other project, which do similar things.
So there's an API that people can write plugins to or can make other plugins work with.
Yeah, that's something which we only kind of relatively recently put in place. The plugin API has been there for about a year, but it's still pretty unstable. So changes to the core are still breaking plugins, and that's probably going to continue for a while. But we hope that as that kind of stabilizes, we can attract more developers to write more kind of new and interesting features that we probably wouldn't want to put straight in the core. I think it allows for a lot more kind of flexibility in terms of experimentation, and it's already borne quite a bit of fruit. The release that we just did, which is 0.10.3, includes kind of, I think, about 5 plugins which ship with the actual Windows build. One of those is the Telescope Control plugin.
So, you know, obviously this thing can say, here's what the sky looks like above my head right now, but there's actually a lot of knobs and dials I can tweak on that, like whether or not I can see the bodies of the constellations and so on. Why don't you talk about some of the knobs that we've got on Stellarium?
Yeah, so you can modify the time pretty much as you wish. There's controls in the bottom right-hand corner, the bottom right-hand side, which control the flow time. You can speed it up and send it backwards and pretty much around as you wish. It's something which, from an educational standpoint, is really kind of important. Yeah, if you click that right-hand button several times, you'll speed up time.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. It's going so fast. No, that's cool.
I see Superman really cool. Circling the world.
Yeah. And we should say, you also get the horizon. So when the sun comes up, you'll see the land.
The atmosphere effect back on.
Yeah.
You should see it.
It's so cool. Sun. Yeah. So that was a whole day you just went through right there.
This is like a scene from the Time Machine.
Yeah, I love it. What should I turn on? Atmosphere? Let me see. Here we go. Yeah. Atmosphere. There we go.
Ooh.
She got a nice sunrise.
Oh, baby. Look at that. That beautiful.
That was actually one of the features which first wowed me. When I first saw Stellarium many years ago, I was just browsing around on SourceForge for any kind of astronomy projects. And I found a couple sort of dotted around the internet. But they all looked pretty kind of on a very clinical looking and not really with a focus on realism or, you know, really wanting to look beautiful. And one of the things which really amazed me about Stellarium was the fact that it, even right back in the early versions, there was a lot of attention to detail to how it looked. And I thought that was a really nice thing. One of the reasons that I'm interested in the project is that I really like to encourage people to get interested in science education, and having something which is visually appealing kind of grabs people at a young age, and I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, it really is very visually appealing, and that, yeah, you're absolutely right. That's just and it's pretty intuitive too. I mean, I wouldn't say I'm an expert using it by any means, but it's pretty straightforward in its operation, which is also good. Kids can get in there and start playing with it right away and see what's going on.
I can see the labels for the larger things there. Yeah, can you turn on labels for smaller things, or is it just whatever you happen to be able to see?
Yeah, if you press F4, you get the dialog boxes, which is all of the sort of display settings. You can slide the sliders at the bottom right of that dialog.
Oh, wow.
how many labels do you want there?
And that's another thing that you simulate really well, which is that, you know, if I'm in the city and I've got a lot of light pollution, mm-hmm. I can only see maybe second and third magnitude stars. If I get out in the country and I can, you know, I got where it's like there's no country, I guess, a country around here, I get away from the city, I can see a lot more stars. And you can actually dial that in as well. You can say, show
kind of
me
match what you've got. Yeah.
Fifth or sixth magnitude there. And the other thing that I saw in there, and you might explain this, is you know, if I'm observing at home, I have a mountain to the east of me and some hills to the east of me that actually block like the first 10 degrees of my view. And I understand there's a feature where you can actually like either draw in or paint in or maybe take actual pictures and actually simulate your actual horizon. Is that right?
Yeah, you can have different landscapes. One of the tabs on the display dialog that you had it was to select different landscapes, and you can customize your own. It's relatively easy. You just have to get a panoramic photo, and then there's a small config file that you have to edit just to tell it what the file name is. Yeah, if you go to landscapes there, you can select from a couple of different ones, which are pre-installed.
I haven't uploaded any, but there's hurricane, there's Mars, there's moon, there's ocean. There's trees. This is great.
Even better in the daytime.
Yeah, all the star lore.
It's one of the things which we get lots of user contributions. Lots of landscapes. There's, I don't know how many, probably somewhere between 50 and 100 wow. Custom landscapes which are on the wiki, which people have donated. Many of them are really interesting locations. Stellarium is used in observatories. Staff and observatories will often need something, a quick reference, and Stellarium kind of fills that need for them. And so there's people who have contributed landscapes from all sorts of places. That is actually Garching, which
yeah,
is...
Yeah, that's Garching.
European Southern Observatory headquarters near Munich.
And here's the default, which is Garin. Now, I understand for fans of 2012, the movie, you also have an Aztec, have some Aztec lawyer in here as well.
Yeah, that was something we decided this release is an Aztec sky culture. When you look up at the sky night and you see and the different constellations, those things are culturally specific. So most people are kind of familiar with the Western sky culture and constellations like Ursa Major, Cassiopeia, and so on. But different civilizations have created different sky cultures over the years. And Stellarium, one of the features which makes it relatively, not necessarily unique, but less common than other applications, is that we have a great many sky cultures. Not all of them are complete. And we have artwork for the Western one. If you go into the sky cultures, you can select different ones and turn on the constellation lines from the bottom toolbar and the constellation artwork as well. And you'll sort of see the different ways that people have visualized the sky throughout the ages.
That's so cool. And again, another great educational feature. So it's more than just looking at the sky. I mean, you're learning about culture as well here, which is fantastic.
Now, you mentioned you had a Mars horizon, right? A Mars layout. And I think that looked like coming from the lander or something. But is it showing the planets as views from Mars? Can I actually travel the different planets with this? Or is it always going to be an Earth-based picture?
Yeah, you can. If you can find a planet in the sky, there's a find feature. You can press Control-F or tap F3 and you get a search dialog. Type in the name of the planet. And then if you press Control-G, then it will move the observer to a particular planet location. You can also do it from the location setup dialog.
Apparently we're on Mars right now. I know.
Yeah, no, the landscape doesn't actually change automatically at the moment. You have to manually select the appropriate landscape.
Oh, okay. Wow, I didn't know Mars looked like France.
It's like Tahoe.
Yeah, Tahoe. That's great. Let me pull that up here and we'll get the Mars landscape. That's very cool. That is neat.
And so you could actually watch an Earthrise from the moon then with this, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Wow, oh, that would neat. Be cool.
That's so neat. So I've got, it looks like I've got the Egyptian sky culture here. And there we are. It's now.
Now, something that you should probably do is find a nebula of some kind, click on it, and then zoom in.
I sped up the world too much. Oh, sorry.
Not good for epileptic.
No, I apologize. We just went through 48 years of evolution right there.
And all the epileptics in the chat room are now
sorry, guys.
On their back.
No, Flash can't do that, I don't think. So, I mean, it's fun. You're giving me all sorts of things to play with here, which is really, really neat. So let me find Earth, I guess.
Just select a thing and press the / key on the keyboard. It should zoom in. And if it's a planet with moons, you can press it again to get kind of second level zoom. So you can kind of simulate the view for telescope and to see something really up close.
Yeah. Wow, that's really neat.
Yeah, if you go back far enough, do you see dinosaurs?
Let's see. Yeah. I don't know. Let's see. I'm looking for them. I don't. I'm zooming. I zoomed way in here, and you can actually see the rover. That's really is the rover's perspective. That's so cool.
Cool.
Yeah.
If you just click on the sun, a left click on the sun.
Yeah.
If you can.
Let's click on the sun.
And then zoom press in. Press the / key. You might want to stop time before it goes down below the horizon. Boy. There you go.
I caught up. It's sunset. Oh, no. I got to go back. Oh, man. Well, let's just speed it up till we get another sunrise and I can go back to the sun. This is so. You can see how the people would just. This is so much fun.
It does. It's crazy. Hey, how does this? Are you familiar with Celestia, and how does this compare to that?
Yeah, Celestia is a great project. I also, when I was originally found Stellarium, I had found Celestia as well. I played with it a lot. It's an interesting project. They don't do quite the same thing. I like to think of them as being complementary, although there's obviously quite a lot of overlap. I think Celestia's probably got a kind of more of a wow factor because you can like literally take off and fly around the galaxy, which is pretty amazing.
It's like Google Sky also. Yeah,
Google Sky, again, Google Sky is probably closer to Stellarium, but it doesn't have lots of the orbital mechanics stuff. So it has full sky surveys with really, really beautiful imagery, which all kind of downloads dynamically, sort of in the same way as, well, it's part of Google Earth, so, which Stellarium doesn't have yet, although we're working on it. But it doesn't have a lot of the orbital mechanics stuff. You can't change the observer location to another planet and so on, as far as I know, at least when I checked it out.
Sounds like you yourself are an amateur astronomer. Is that how you got it? You were looking at these programs. You must have had some interest in astronomy.
I studied astronomy as an undergraduate.
Aha.
Although I probably can't really class myself as an amateur astronomer. I don't actually have a telescope. Stellarium kind of fills that need for me without having to, move country because it's always cloudy in the UK.
Yeah, so what's the point? This is for people who live in cloudy climates, you know.
Portland, Oregon, for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And so the images that we're seeing, this is an open source program. You get it for free. So the images must all be public domain or easily licensed images?
Yeah. There's a couple of different conditions on different images. Some of them are used with permission. For instance, the Milky Way image was is kind of used under permission. It's okay to redistribute according to an agreement which was made between Fabian and the creator of the image. Quite a few of the images are taken from sort of scientific surveys, and those are very often published under public domain or sort of liberal licenses. For instance, all NASA imagery is released under the public domain as part of NASA's kind of way of doing things. There are some, like the Milky Way image, for example, that's slightly, it's not completely certain if that's redistributable by a third party in terms of screenshots and things. And it's one of the biggest outstanding questions that we have, because we can't really, we don't want to consult a lawyer over it. It's difficult to do that. Yeah, but for the most part, all the imagery is either public domain or it's explicitly licensed as open source. But there are a few which are just used with explicit permission.
I think it's funny. Milky Way provided by permission.
Because, you know, somebody's got to permit it.
Somebody's got to own the Milky Way.
I understand one of the features of the recent release, because you just had a new release, I guess, in the last few weeks, is that you added satellite tracking. So we can do. Can we finally see where the ISS is then, for example?
Yeah, that's one of the features which I was personally involved in. We did a release about a week ago, which is having mixed results because we have some problems with specific hardware. But yeah, you can sort of locate the ISS and sort of fast forward in time and see when it's going to come overhead. It passes over most places on the planet once every sort of a couple of weeks. It's really impressive if you know where to look and what to look for. It looks like a very bright star or even kind of like a plane, but without flashing lights coming overhead. And it's really nice to be able to look up and just know that, you know, 200 miles up or however far it is, you know, there's a bunch of people up there. It's kind of cool.
Are you going to have all the Iridium satellites in there too?
All the Iridium ones are in there, although we don't calculate Iridium flares yet.
That's so cool. When I first found out about that was just like my favorite thing to do was go calculate Iridium flares.
What's that?
You don't know about Iridium flares, Leo?
No, tell me.
An iridium flare, I worked on iridium, so this is part of why I'm fascinated by these things. The iridium satellites had a unique feature in that they have these two giant solar panel arrays to power them. I think they're also antennas. No, their antennas are all otherwise. So, but they have these giant flat things, and they're very reflective. And so they actually catch the light from the sun, and it's so flat that it creates a spot on the ground. So as the satellite comes by at just exactly the right angle, you can see this thing bright up.
Have like you seen one?
Yes. Oh, I've seen dozens of them because there's a program somewhere that actually calculates them. And so, but you can dial in where you are and how many days you want to. And there's sometimes.
So what do? You just stand at a point and wait for the thing to come by?
There's sometimes -3 magnitude. No, it tells you exactly when it's going to be, but they're -3 magnitude. They're bright. You can see them without even a binoculars.
And I presume moving very quickly, right?
Yeah, they only it only lasts for about 3 or 4 seconds. It goes, it's really fast, but it's really cool.
So there's a website called Heavens Above, which will calculate iridium flares. You tell it your location, and then it'll tell you what flares are sort of coming over the next, I think, 24 hours or 7 days. Yeah, and it's really impressive if you see one. I mean, seeing a satellite at all, most people have probably seen them and don't know what they are. They're just like a star, which is kind of moving at a constant speed. And many satellites that you'll see will be very dim, so people might mistake them for players, just not know what they are or not even notice them. What a flare is, and like Randall said, these iridium satellites have big flat panels on them, and they're always oriented in a predictable way. I think there's one at 60 degrees offset to the direction of travel of the satellite, and they're angled down at a particular angle. Just by doing some simple trigonometry, if you know the position of the observer of the sun, you can work out where the spot is, because it's focused in quite a small area, so a few kilometers across. By the time it sort of shines down on the planet, you can basically work out when and where you're going to see a brightening as that kind of reflective beam sort of passes over the observer. Hmm. And it can be very, very bright. If you think about the sort of the brightest stars are about magnitude. Are they? Oh my goodness, I'm going to totally fail on the numbers now. What's Sirius? I don't know. -4 or something. Some stars use weird scales and negative values of bright.
So the larger the number, the larger the number, the brighter. Yeah, the brighter they are.
Yeah, it's quite fascinating to look at.
The more another
question I had about this is you can run the time controls to observe when things happen, but can you also say, tell me when I'm going to get a lunar eclipse? Is there some math in here somewhere, some buttons I can push to calculate those things?
Not yet. Yeah, if you know when there's going to be one, then you can go to those sort of time and space coordinates and get to observe it. It's definitely a planned feature to have kind of what's going to happen over the next week or something. It's a feature which I think the pros have where what's up tonight? You tell me what is interesting to observe this evening. I'd like to do that, but not yet. We're sort of hoping the plugin infrastructure will allow sort of more developers to come to the project and sort of do interesting things like that. The last kind of 2 years or so of development, maybe 3 years, have been largely infrastructural. We had a developer meeting in 2007. It kind of got to a stalemate because the original big lot of development had left a bit of a messy code base. And we also were drawing all of the user interface kind of manually with OpenGL calls, which, while it was very fast and okay, it was extremely labor-intensive to engineer a new user interface and features. So we made a big infrastructural change and started using the Qt widget set to draw the sort of GUI elements. Mm-hmm. And having kind of restructuring the program over the last couple of years, and that's kind of finished now. There are a few things left to do, but as the stage of that, we're now ready to have new features rolled out in the shape of plugins. That's finally kind of borne fruit. There's been some trouble as well, but
So given you've got more development going on, or you're trying to get more development going on, what kind of people are you looking for? I mean, if you had your ideal list of candidates, who are you particularly wanting to help you with this project?
Really anyone who's enthusiastic about it and can sort of help in some way. There are lots of ways that people can help with Stellarium. Mm-hmm. The user documentation is kind of languishing a bit now. It's pretty good. It has a pretty kind of good base, but it could do with updating for the last release. And we always need people for doing translations. One of the features that I'd very much like to have implemented would be to make it easy for people to put their own image catalogs into the program. So we have a catalog of about 100 nebulae and things, which you can zoom in on and get a lot of detail in. But I personally would like to make it easy for people to add those. At the moment, the process of adding an image on the sky is kind of laborious to get it all aligned. I think once we've got a sort of tool for doing that easily, we'd like to attract the kind of amateur astronomy hordes to be able to upload their pictures and maybe have like a big, kind of a shared sort of ecosystem of imagery that people can get, maybe even have it kind of dynamically downloading, although that's quite a long way in the future.
Yeah, I was going to say, maybe you could coordinate with something that's like OpenStreetMap, but for the sky, like OpenSkyMap or something.
Ooh,
is that possible? Yeah. Is that somebody already doing that? I hope there's somebody already doing that, but maybe there isn't.
Someone should be doing it.
Mm-hmm. There we go. There we go. Anybody out there? That's your call of duty. Let's get this going.
OpenStreetMap's another one of my the projects that I contribute to as well.
Ah, nice.
I know that you had a guy from OpenStreetMap on.
We really enjoyed that. Yeah.
Yeah, OpenStreetMap is great. Right. They've done amazing work after the earthquake in Haiti recently. The kind of the publicly available maps of Port-au-Prince were not particularly good. Even the commercial maps were kind of ropey. But I think Yahoo published some satellite imagery, which was taken after the disaster. And within about 48 hours, the OpenStreetMap of pretty much the whole of Haiti was, as far as I can tell, the kind of best publicly available map on the internet.
Wow.
It's absolutely amazing. Yeah. The power of that project is astonishing.
That's really, really great.
And that, so I'm sure that would have saved lives. It must have helped coordinate relief efforts.
Absolutely. So definitely one of the things that we appreciate about open source is that, if you have it in the hands of the right people, they can use it to empower you in all sorts of interesting and useful ways. Mm-hmm. 0.10.3 just came out. You helped with that, you said. When is it going to be on OS 10? I tried to download it. It's not there yet. When is it going to be out?
our Mac porters are working on it at the moment. One of the things which we have hoped that a move to using Qt as the underlying library would help with was kind of getting rid of platform-specific issues. But although Qt does very well in removing having to have ifdefs all over your code and having to compile things for different platforms with different code in, it's still not quite there, especially with sorts of things which Solarian does. We're using OpenGL very heavily, and there are still kind of hardware-specific problems based around that. Qt has only relatively recently started having sophisticated OpenGL functionality, so it's still a little bit leading edge. But we're kind of hoping that that's going to improve over time. Right now, we still have to do quite a few little workarounds and things to get things working on different platforms. So it's in the works, but it'll be coming out soon.
Okay, well, I'll keep watching the website. I'll just keep hitting reload every day. Just keep it up there. Reload. Eventually be there. let's see. I'm just making sure that we covered everything that... what's Nightshade?
Oh, yeah. We actually have a fork in the project. The aforementioned Rob Spearman, guy who sponsored some small planetarium-specific features earlier on the development of Stellarium. He has a business which serves the small planetarium community, and since we did this big sort of change to Qt, there's been some stability issues and some features we use specifically which are not re-implemented yet in the kind of big redeveloped version. They're coming, but in the meantime, Rob has fallen off from an older version of Stellarium before the switch to Qt. That's called Nightshade. I think it's kind of interesting. It's nice to see that there are people who rely on Stellarium enough for the stability issues to really be a kind of problem. I think there's probably a chance of re-merging later on, but it's kind of difficult in some ways technically because the code base has changed so much in the main branch. But we'll see.
Uh-oh. I don't know if we've lost him or... Are you there?
Just stop.
I'm still here.
Oh, good. Matthew, I really want to thank you. What a great project it is. And thank Fabian, too, for putting all this effort into it. I know it's a lot of work to not just create it, but then to continue to update it. And you guys have been updating Stellarium for some time now. Just really great. And don't listen to it. Don't worry about the Mac version. When you get it out, it'll be fine. He's so impatient.
I'm selfish.
Not selfish. There's a lot of us running the... Yeah, well, we're running the older. I'm running the older version on the Mac, and it runs very nicely. In fact, that's what we were showing on the video. Thank you, Matthew. Stay warm, okay?
You're welcome.
All right, take care. Matthew Gates with Stellarium, stellarium.org, if you want to download a copy. And if you're listening to the podcast, it should be safe to enter the water and download it. It's really fun to play with. It's the kind of thing, you know, I'm always looking for ways to inspire kids to get into something. You know, just anything. And I think astronomy is one of the things that always turned me on as a kid. And this is a great way. You just put this on their computer, you don't mention it, and they start playing with it, and you never know. You might have an astronomer.
Well, astronomy is one of these interesting sciences that's really sort of immediately, you know, relatable. You know, like you start doing chemistry and stuff, you kind of have to worry about it. And you know, do physics is all. But astronomy is like everybody is fascinated with the stars. I don't know anybody who isn't. You know, you go out at night and there's like stars up there, and or you know, and especially the rare times when you can see like, you know, Venus or something. It's this is really cool. It's, and so to have this kind of a quality program, you know, this would clearly be something that would be worth a couple hundred bucks as a commercial option.
And
to have it available as for open source, for education, for people to share, for people to learn from. And also the fact that, you know, you can also get in and tinker with it, because this is what open source is about. We can add things. We can add plugins. We can script it. We can do all sorts of great stuff with it. So just it's incredible that open source lets us have access to this kind of stuff.
Open source FTW.
Wouldn't be much of a show for Floss Weekly.
That's kind of our motto. Source. Exactly. Who do you have coming up for future episodes?
My God, I got a whole bunch of people. In fact, I'm booking a bunch of new people right now. I actually opened up March's booking, so I've got a bunch of people on the short list for that. Next week we have Henrique Bastos, who is the open source. He has a lot to say about open source in Rio de Janeiro, so that's going to be a lot of fun. Yeah. I'll probably have a thick Portuguese accent, but that's okay. I'm so used to that from being down there in Brazil, so I might have to translate. Actually, I haven't talked to him. He probably speaks perfect English instead. But, and he also wants to talk a little bit about PyCon, the Python conference. Apparently, he's big on the operation. Right after that, we got Sebastian Branstam, who is going to talk to us about Symbian and what they're doing for the open source world with Symbian. Jamie Cameron coming up after that with WebMin, which is an administration interface for your system to control everything just from the web. One of the old ones, actually, sort of the original place for that. Just added to the list, we have Carlos Puchel, who's going to talk to us about the Amahai Home Server. It's basically a Linux distro that is configured for being basically your sort of your media PC, your firewall, your everything. It's an all-in-one Linux distro that's configured just the way you want it for your basically home network systems. You know, built-in OpenBSD or OpenVPN, so you can get back to your box and sorts of cool things. So we just added him to the list. That's going to be a lot of fun. Matt Ray of Zenos is going to pop in. Zenos, I forgot what that is. Some content management system, I think. He's going to be mad at me for not remembering what it is now that I've added him to the schedule. And also just added or just about to be added, I've been using CMake on a lot of new projects. And I said, what the heck is CMake? Because everything requires me to install it so I can install everything else. And it's a great open source replacement for Make using more powerful configuration tools. So Bill Hoffman, the creator of CMake, is coming on the short list. You can go to twit.tv/floss and see all the upcoming guests on that. You can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/Merlyn, M-E-R-L-Y-N, to see places that I'm going to be. And you can also see when I've booked a new guest for Floss Weekly. I tend to announce it right there immediately. And speaking of where I'm going to be coming up soon, I'm going to be at Scale, the Southern California Linux Expo, in a couple of weeks. So if you happen to be in the SoCal area and haven't already enrolled and weren't already planning on being there, maybe you'll stop by just because I'm there. I don't know. I'm going to be – actually, I have two roles to do there. I'm going to be both representing Linux Fund. I'll be hanging out at the Linux Fund booth for a while to talk about how you can, using a credit card, you can help fund open source projects. I'll also be speaking about Smalltalk. I'm doing my Smalltalk presentation there about CSite being your next web programming language. So I'm actually officially a speaker this year, not just press. I'm also going to be hanging out with Randy Harper, who we had on a few weeks ago, FreeBSD girl. She's going to be presenting on women in open source, sort of addressing some of the stuff that we covered in our conference a couple weeks ago with her. So I'll be with her chatting about that. So if you're anywhere in the Southern California area or can get there in a couple of weeks, then come see me.
Scale is supposed to be a great event. I've always wanted to go.
It is really cool. And it's a lot of the people that we've had on the show are usually our regular speakers at scale. It's a really good chance to network and interface. And it's one of the, I think it's like the second biggest or third, maybe the third biggest, like Linux Expo. So it's really where a lot of open source stuff actually goes on. It's just pretty cool. I enjoy it. I only went first time last year. So it's kind of nice to be back again and to have actually a role where I'm actually on the speaker program. So it's a lot of fun. I'm still looking for work, by the way. It's still a lot of stuff in the air, but nothing actually happening yet. So if you can hire a good Perl hacker, that would be me, Merlin at Stonehenge.com.
Really, and he says hacker in the best way.
The good way.
Just
another Perl hacker way, which is sort of a meme now within the Perl community.
Is it really just another J-A-P-H?
J-A-P-H. Well, it started out because I used to sign my Usenet postings. That's how far back this goes. I used to sign my Usenet postings with just another whatever hacker, depending on whatever group I was in. Like if it was Unix, it'd be just on the Unix hacker and stuff. Well, I started posting to the Perl group a lot. And so that kept being over and over again, just another Perl hacker. Just another Perl hacker. Got bored with that. So I started obfuscating it slightly. So I'd print like the reverse of the string. So it'd be the string in reverse, and then it would actually print out just another Perl hacker. And some of them got very, very complex. And it actually created a whole sort of subculture within the Perl culture to write these obfuscated Perl codes that generate just another Perl hacker and other various things. So it's pretty pretty bizarre. So I take credit for that. There's actually a Wikipedia article on just another Perl hacker. So you can pull that up and see the whole history of it there, including some really bizarre ones that I have there. One of them takes the phrase, oh, turtleneck phrase jar.
What?
And rearranges it to be just another Perl hacker. Oh, turtleneck phrase jar just happens to be an anagram of just another Perl
Amazing hacker. Coincidence? I think not.
Oh, turtleneck phrase jar.
Oh, turtleneck phrase jar. How little did I know you were just another Perl hacker. Randall, you're full of such strange things, you know. It's amazing, Harry, how you come about your amazing style and shape.
Yeah, but I do believe also we'll have Jono back next week. I think so. It's been good. I mean, missed him a couple of weeks, but that's okay. He can go and come as he pleases. He's always welcome. And
yes, as can our audience. But we hope they'll come more than they go.
I don't even know where he's going
come
with that.
Out, right?
No.
Let's leave it at that and say thank you for joining us. Make sure you watch the show. We do it live every Wednesday afternoon at 4:30 Eastern, 1:30 Pacific. That would be 21:30 UTC at live.twit.tv.
In the winter. In the summer, it's 20:30.
But it's not the summer now. Well, I guess you could be listening to this in the summer.
That's
you figure it out.
Just
get yourself a clock. You figure it out. But we are on. You can find us. Just watch. You know what? The best thing to do, watch live.twit.tv all the time.
Yeah, you'll never miss this show.
You'll never miss this or any of the other great things that we do.
Incredible.
Randall, thanks so much. Have a great week. We'll see you next time on Floss Weekly.